Welcome to the Upper West Side Reality, the podcast that dives deep into stories, secrets, and ever-changing dynamics of one of New York City's most iconic neighborhoods. From charming brownstones to bustling streets, we explore what makes Upper West Side tick, and today, what leaves it vacant. On this episode, we're tackling the issue of vacancies on the Upper West Side, those empty storefronts and spaces that leave us all wondering what's next for this neighborhood we love so much. Joining us today is the brilliant Professor Rebecca Amato, an expert in urban history and development. She's here to help us unravel the history behind these vacancies and what they mean for the future of our community. Whether you're a lifelong Upper West Sider or just a fan of its charm, this is the conversation you won't want to miss. So grab your coffee, find a cozy spot, and let's talk about the reality of the Upper West Side. I came across your book, and it led. So I was looking across JSTOR, and it led me to your chapter 12, actually, on empty spaces, silence, and the pause. And and I loved reading it. I mean, it was really cool to hear your input on like the situation. And yeah, so I thought it could really find an answer to this problem, or at least a little justification of why this is happening in my neighborhood.
It's a very good question. And just so you know, that chapter is the only chapter I wrote in that book. It's an anthology of many different scholars and thinkers writing about gentrification from the perspective of aesthetics. So when you think about, just to give you some more of a summary of that book, the idea of gentrification is something that you know what it is when you see it. When you go to different cities in the world, you can get the same cup of coffee, you can see the same fashion, that kind of thing. So that's part of the aesthetic idea, but I was kind of playing with that idea in my essay to look at the way that an aesthetic of emptiness becomes part of creating the dream of creating something new.
I wanted to touch upon how I saw that you previously worked at the Tenement Museum, and I thought that was I thought that was really cool. I just wanted to say, like, I went there as a kid during my field trips, and I just thought it was just such a cool experience. When I was doing my research, I saw that. I thought that was a really cool.
Yeah, I think I might have worked there before you were born.
Really?
So, in fact, I can tell you for sure it was before you were born. But yes, it was, and it was a formative experience, and relates a little bit to that article you read and some of my research interests. So
yeah, that's really cool. Okay, so let's, I feel like, dive right in. my first question is, it's just like a general question about like New York City and gentrification and then like urban transformation, and it's, how has your research shaped your understanding of the relationship between like urban memory and the gentrification of neighborhoods like the Upper West Side?
Yeah. So, well, I'm glad you mentioned the Tenement Museum, because I started working there in 1999 and left in 2002. And in that short period of time, the Lower East Side, I could see it changing. So I remember when I first started working there, I was fairly new to New York, and I was really excited about the job and walked to the Lower East Side from where I was living a little bit further north at NYU dorms, just to see what it was all about. And I remember it feeling, in this particular part of town, it felt really empty. And empty insofar as I didn't see that many people on the streets, and I didn't even feel like it was very well lit. And I thought, this seems a little odd, because I feel like so much of New York is dense and active and busy all the time. And so I thought, is this really, is this a good neighborhood? And of course, I come from Chicago. I'm living in Chicago again now. You read cities differently. And so when I would see that in Chicago, I would be like, this is danger. When I see that in New York, it's just a part of the fabric of New York, is some places are not super active at night. And so and I really also would say that I would revise the idea of what's a good neighborhood and what's a bad neighborhood. It's been many years since I had that idea about bad neighborhoods. So in any case, I went there. That was my first impression. And then as I continued to work there, there were new shops opening up. There was a contrast between the people who were coming to the museum and the people who lived in the neighborhood. And I was spending more time there, and I began to realize that this was a neighborhood that was changing. And so what constitutes change? What causes change? These were some of the questions that I wanted to unpack for myself in that period of time. It was a personal question. And then at the end of 2002, the museum was part of a kind of a battle with the owner of the building next door to it, over the museum wanting to protect that building next door because it was attached to the landmark tenement, and there was construction happening. The tenement museum wanted to buy the building next door, and the people didn't want to sell. And that opened up a whole question around who has the right to develop a neighborhood. They were renovating, they were doing construction because they were renovating their building to put it on the market for rentals at what at that time seemed like exorbitant prices. And so then that became a sort of another focal point of like maybe part of gentrification is understanding the increase in rental prices, the increase in the market, and what it like who benefits from that. And so those were the kinds of questions that shaped my early interest in gentrification. And then over time, I started to understand a little bit more about housing rights injustice in New York City. And I would say from around the time of Bloomberg's election as mayor of New York to the present, this which is around when I left the Tenement Museum, the transformation of New York has been dramatic in terms of increasing rental prices, the development and overdevelopment of neighborhoods that have transformed completely in the last 20 years, and then the sort of and Bloomberg used this term himself, the sort of selling of New York as a luxury product. So it no longer becomes a place where anybody can thrive, but you do have to have a certain amount of capital to be able to thrive. And so that's something that I was first interested in early on, and then it developed over time. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, completely. I know, touching on the luxury part, you mentioned about this luxury glut in your article, and it said, and I was just wondering, like, what do you think, like, the consequences of New York City's, like, current luxury glut on housing and the market in, like, local communities? Like, how do you think that's, like, influencing them?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, you have buildings that are out of character for the rest of the neighborhood, insofar as, first of all, they're new and fancier. But secondly, many of those buildings provide a lot of services that you wouldn't, that you would otherwise get outside of your building. So, this is not the Upper West Side. This is Williamsburg, is my example, but this may be true in the Upper West Side now. I haven't lived there in a few years. But in Williamsburg, when they did the waterfront development around where Domino Sugar Factory used to be and all that kind of stuff, sort of the South First, South Second, and then the North First, North Second, all that kind of area. When they first started doing that development, they built beautiful glass towers, residential buildings for folks who clearly weren't the people who already lived there, because the people who already lived there would never be able to afford that. So you're bringing in people from other parts of the world probably to live there. So for the first thing is those buildings were offering services like dry cleaning, a gym, a hairdresser. The kinds of things that feel really exciting because it's a full service building if you live there. But what it means is you're not bringing your dollars into your community. And you're also not interacting with your neighbors or other people in your community because you're getting everything that you need where you are. And so there's that part, which is a sort of like almost like a spaceship landing and saying, we'll be here. We're just not going to have any kind of experience with the rest of you. We're just here to occupy, right? So there's that idea. There's also the fact that a lot of those buildings, as I wrote about in the article, are in fact empty most of the time. They are pied-à-terres for people who don't live in the city but might live outside of the city and sometimes come hang out in the city. They are maybe more than a pied-à-terre for people who may own many different houses. And a lot of them, so there's that kind of situation where somebody's only there part of the year because they live someplace else the rest of the year. And then there are a lot of those buildings are owned by corporations as their own rentals. So you recruit a new person to work in your corporation in New York City. We'll give you housing for this amount of time, but then that's not a home. That's sort of a holding pattern, a placeholder for somebody until they find someplace else. And so there's just absolutely no connection to place. And there's no connection to the people in the neighborhood. The final thing about that is democracy. So if you're not living there, you may not even be eligible to vote in New York City. So, but if you are, you may not really be paying attention to politics or caring about the impact of your vote on the people around you. But if you aren't eligible to vote in New York City, if you're from Oklahoma and you're visiting for, 2 months out of the year, or if you're from another country, you are not paying any attention to what happens to regular people who live there year round. And that also means that you have a decline in the number of people who live in the city who can actually vote on behalf of city services.
Also, to touch upon the new buildings. So, say, like the wealthier community used to live in one area, but then there's this new and up and coming one. So, they moved to the new up and coming one. And you touched on it how the lower income families now recycle the old neighborhoods. So, what happens in the old neighborhoods? Do the prices become just cheaper, or does it stay the same and the new areas are just more expensive?
Well, I guess if economies worked in a straightforward fashion and they were entirely predictable, there would be no economists in the world. So the idea of filtering, which is what I talked about in the essay, is that you build more and more luxury housing, and eventually there will be enough supply that the prices will get lower, and people who have lesser means will be able to afford the higher quality product. That's also a whole question if luxury is actually a higher quality product. But anyway, so there's that side of it. The other side is that like you have more and more stuff. Right, the person who lives in Park Slope in, let's say I lived in Brooklyn, so that's my reference point. But somebody lives in Park Slope in 1995, they're living in like a great, like kind of an up and coming neighborhood. But then suddenly Brooklyn Heights gets developed in 2005, and you move to Brooklyn Heights. So you're moving up the ladder of housing, but you've left your home behind in Park Slope. And the idea of filtering would be that that place in Park Slope is now has aged, isn't as valuable, and therefore somebody with lesser means could probably afford it. That's the idea. And then that goes down and down the line. But that's not actually what happens, because that Park Slope apartment in 2005 is renovated and then sold for much higher than it would have been otherwise. Because the filtering idea suggests, first of all, that things are no longer attractive once they've been left, attractive to people with means. And the second thing is that nothing happens to those properties. Like they aren't renovated, they aren't demolished and turned into something else. And so That's why all of those that kind of idea can sound really good, but that's not actually how it works. And that's why New York City, Chicago, most of the nation is suffering an affordable housing crisis. Because if building all those luxury buildings that you've seen go up in your lifetime really solved the problem, we wouldn't have people living on the streets.
Going back to just like general questions about gentrification, I really liked how you paralleled this idea of gentrification to like colonialism. I thought that was really fascinating. I didn't even make that connection in my head. What do you think inspired you to make that comparison?
It wasn't just me. I wasn't the first person to come up with the idea. In fact, when I was living in Brooklyn, I lived basically in Flatbush or on the west side of Flatbush on Ocean Parkway. Flatbush is a West Indian neighborhood, Black West Indian neighborhood, with a mixture of lots of other people. And there were slogans on the streets. People had made stickers, had spray painted, whatever, created little stencils that said gentrification is colonization. And they weren't the first people to come up with that either. But it is a slogan now that I've seen at least in Brooklyn. The idea is that sort of the framing of the essay that I offered was that the view of the colonizer and the view of the gentrifier are in some ways really similar. And when I say the gentrifier, I'm not talking about the person who moves into an apartment because they can afford it, even though they may not know that everybody else in the neighborhood can't afford it. I'm talking about the developers, the investors, the sometimes nefarious actors that are there before who prepare the space for gentrification first. So the gentrifier and the colonizer are looking at space as if there's nothing there that's worth keeping, as if nothing there is, as if literally nothing is there. There are no people, there's no land that's worthy, there's no Or that land would be worthy only if something were built on it that they can envision. It's sort of, in some ways, a utopian vision because, okay, we have a blank slate, we're going to build something new. Imagine the people colonizing the new world, in the 15, 16, and 17 centuries, coming to this country or this land and saying, oh, well, there's some people there, but they don't need to be. Whatever, they're not us, they don't matter. We'll figure out something about them. But look at how great this land is for us. So it's the same kind of idea. It erases the present qualities and present residents of a place, including all of the flora and fauna. It imagines that place as something different that fits their own vision of what it ought to be. And it usually transforms the ability of anybody who already is there to stay there. And then I guess I sometimes bristle at the idea that any place has character, like a specific character that is stable and lasts over time. But I will say that gentrification transforms the character of a place. And what remains are shadows and memories of what they might have been or what they were before gentrification happened.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, especially like on the Lower East Side, as you were saying, it was like this dark and like desolate neighborhood. And now, like me, like going downtown today, like I feel like it's like there's coffee shops on every corner, and then there's like these active, like expensive thrift stores. And I think that just like proves your point exactly.
I do want to say, like, it wasn't like it was empty. I mentioned that I said it was empty at that time and it felt empty. And it may have been that there weren't that many stores open on the block that I was on or whatever, because Lower East Side has never been an empty neighborhood. There has never been a time in its history when it wasn't populated and had culture and other activities, but it definitely has changed over time.
Now, like gearing towards more of like the Upper West Side, in like the chapter, you described empty spaces as like a moment of pause in the urban narrative. How do you see this concept like playing out specifically on the Upper West Side?
I do not claim to be an authority in the Upper West Side because I'm not sure I've been to the Upper West Side in 10 years. For one reason, I live here now in Chicago, but also, once you find your place, you don't travel that much around the city. I think what I heard you say when we first started talking was that you are seeing vacancies on the Upper West Side in a part of the city that by all rights should be dense in every way. And so, like in terms of people, in terms of people living there, in terms of housing, I mean, in terms of shopping and the like. And you're seeing that there are places that are going vacant, and it's a strange sight to see. And so I think it's a it, so for a city that's constantly moving, to see anything that is empty feels like a moment for us to reflect on what's causing that to happen. And there are a couple of reasons that I can think of why that might be happening. There are probably many other reasons that would account for it. One is what I was talking about in the essay, which I'm not sure is happening in New York in the same way anymore. So I just want to put a caveat on that. There was a point where a lot of landholders, property holders in neighborhoods were sort of holding space vacant and waiting for something more expensive to come along. So they were like, I can hold out for a few months and not get rent from this company because I think something else is going to come that's going to be even bigger. So it was sort of and in that period of time, while they may not be collecting rent, the value of their property is still going up. So while it's not liquid, they don't have access to the value of their property going up. They do have that equity being built. And so it sometimes is worthwhile to just leave a space empty rather than go through the trouble of renting it out. So that might be one reason this is happening. Another reason might be that, and you can probably guess this, a lot of stores don't have brick and mortar versions of themselves anymore because it's actually sort of a drain on assets when they're selling everything online already. And so the use of a brick and mortar store that might have like a 10,000, I'm not coming up with a number that's probably low, a $10,000 a month rental for a storefront on the Upper West Side is not worth it if you're making $10,000 in online sales in like an hour anyway, And so I think that's another reason you're seeing some of the shops that you might expect to see. And I'm talking about like brands that have an existence online and have maybe more than one store around the city. But if that's what's happening, if those things are like Coach is driving up the price of a storefront because it can do that, that means your mom and pop store really can't do that. So I'm always amazed when I see any kind of independently owned store in any neighborhood of New York, because the only explanation I can come up with for that is they own the building and therefore they can keep their store open, or they have some kind of fabulous relationship with the landlord who is willing to keep it open, or is willing to charge them what they can afford, I should say. Or like third option is there's something about that business that is itself a commodity. The Strand bookstore, for example,
I
which I
love that
think is
store,
still
yeah.
open, but there was a period of time when it was on the verge of closing, partly because of rent. Like the Strand bookstore is a brand, it's a commodity as a brand. Who cares about the books, right? And so for the landlord of that building to say, I'm going to get rid of you and wait for something more expensive to come along that I can make more money off, might not have been the right political and economic decision in the long run. So that would be another reason.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Yeah, there's also this one block right next to my house, and it's 66 and Broadway, and Century 21 and Banana Republic used to be there, two massive chains and stores. But I think your point about the online sales really like shows why they closed these massive stores, because it was two stores that took up a whole city block and closed, and they've been closed for years, and no other
Wow.
store can go inside it because it's such a massive space. What company's going to use it?
Yeah, well, there's a
Yeah.
whole other angle that I, and this is to complete hearsay, not based on research, but there's this whole other angle of what did they call it? Like mid fashion? I don't know. It was basically like Banana Republic, J. Crew. There's a certain kind of fashion that's sort of not luxury, but like accessible to everybody, not everybody, accessible to middle class, upper middle class people. And that fashion, it's sort of like the squeezing of the middle class. It's like that fashion is also being squeezed out, so that there's really only fast fashion, stuff you can get really cheap, really fast, and luxury. And so that middle, so that's so outside of the brick and mortar situation, those businesses as a whole are starting to decline as well for reasons that are hard to understand, but that probably has to do with like, I don't know how the fashion industry works, but it's something like
Yeah,
that.
no, for sure. I know. And because of these vacant properties, how do you think these vacant properties influence the perception of decline in like urban neighborhoods? Like all these closed stores, like how does like a person who wants to buy in that neighborhood, how does someone like view that? Is it like appealing or not appealing?
I mean, it's definitely unappealing. I mean,
Yeah.
there are a couple ways I would answer that. On the one hand, it drives you to continue to do more online shopping because you can't get the thing you want to get in your own neighborhood. And then that drives like the lack of interaction with the people who have something to do with your shopping experience. So when I get a delivery from Amazon, I never see my Amazon delivery person. So I'm not having an interaction with that person. That person didn't help me pick the right size. You know, there's no human exchange and transaction in that moment. And that already creates a sense of, well, first of all, it means you're not seeing that stuff anymore, but it increases the decline of stores existing in your neighborhood. But it also means that your ability to interact with other people and your tendency to sort yourself only with into the groups of people that you feel like encountering increases. And that creates loneliness, that creates less of a civic feeling, that creates all sorts of things. So as much as, you know, I might believe that things are overpriced, I would rather that there were a boutique in my neighborhood than an empty vacant store. So on that level, there's that situation. That's my answer. And then there's another answer. The other answer would be from the angle of Jane Jacobs, who you might have read in one of your classes. She wrote a book in the early 60s, I think it's early 60s, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And she writes about living in Greenwich Village in that period of time, the 50s and 60s, and the kind of the dance of urban life. And but she one of the things she points out is the way in which the storekeepers of your neighborhood are part of your sense of home and your sense of safety, meaning that if you're walking alone at night in the neighborhood and maybe somebody's following you, the storekeeper is probably watching because the storekeeper has their store open and you can feel safer and you have a place to go. So there's like that's the extreme example. But the other example would be like, oh, I you know, whatever, I forgot to bring $5 to buy this thing, and my storekeeper knows me and cares about me and says, just bring your $5 the next time. So you create relationships and human connections when stores are open in your neighborhood. And when you know that there's somebody there that you can always go to with a question or something because they're paying attention to the neighborhood too.
Yeah, that was a great answer.
Cool.
Now, yeah, sorry. So now I just want to like reflect a little and want to talk about like the activism, like the advocacy, like about gentrification. I was just like wondering what actions can urban planners and historians, or maybe like public humanities professors like yourself can take to like ensure vacant spaces are like reclaimed in different ways.
Oh, I love that question because I think there's so many ways that space can be used in a way that amplifies human connection. So, I mean, in terms of urban planners, I know that there's a great community planning office within New York City government that a woman I know is part of that they're working to bring together community members to determine how to use different spaces in their neighborhood. So I love the idea that you have listening sessions with the people who already live there to find out what matters to them, what kinds of things they'd like to see happen in the spaces that exist in their neighborhoods. And you know, this does happen and has happened over many years. What unfortunately also happens is that often after all the listening sessions, for whatever reason, the Real Estate Board of New York, whatever reason is that, you know, lobbying and money, the Real Estate Board of New York pretty much calls the shots anyway. So I mean, and this happened with the redevelopment of the Williamsburg waterfront, Williamsburg Greenpoint waterfront. It's happened in a lot of different ways. But there is always room for a democratic experience to happen in planning for space. In terms of humanists and artists and people who, you know, will always see space as more than space. Basically, we'll always see space as place. I think there are lots of placemaking activities and placekeeping activities that can be supported. So I can tell you right now, I've spent the last 3 months trying to find space for a class that I run as part of my current job. It's a class in the humanities for adults who haven't had access to higher ed in the past and don't have the income to be able to afford to go to college. And they earn college credit through this program. I have not found a space yet. So I am talking to all sorts of organizations and agencies. I'm hoping, you know, today or tomorrow is the day when it all happens. But if we had the will and the ability to use vacant storefronts or other kinds of spaces for things like classes, for just educational purposes, for artists' performances, for art exhibits, for community gardening, for a million other, a barbecue, like a million other things that have something to do with people being together and people thinking together, we would be much better off as a society, I think. We would also just have the opportunity to, for those of us who are creatives, to have our stuff seen, you know, without having to have an agent or a gallery that we're affiliated with. Or something else. So, yeah, I think that would be an awesome use of vacant space.
Definitely just like
Definitely.
growing community. I feel like it's just so important in like a neighborhood. Like it's sad to say, but like I don't even like know my neighbors like next door to me, like across the hall. I feel like in New York City, everyone's just so like isolated in their apartment. And I feel like just like having a community center is just such like an important part of a community, like to bring everyone together. Then my next question is for the future of New York City's neighborhoods. How do you see neighborhoods like the Upper West Side or any like in Manhattan and Brooklyn evolving in the face of ongoing gentrification? And what role can humanities play in guiding these changes?
Oh, I love this question. I think there will always be in New York City a battle between development, the people who want to make a profit, who are only interested in making a profit. Or primarily, and the people who are just trying to have a home. That battle is going to continue. It's going to take different shapes. Gentrification is the term we use for it now. Colonization could be the term we use for it again. There could be other terms that we use, but that is ultimately a battle that is part of the DNA of New York City. So that's what I see in the future, is it's going to keep going. It's just maybe going to transform in stakes and methods. I love the idea of using the humanities as a way of community organizing. So you just mentioned not really knowing your neighbors, not knowing how to connect. It does feel awkward to knock on the door of your neighbor across the hallway and be like, hi, I live across the hall and I don't really have anything to say, but I just wanted to say hello. Most people don't have the gumption, I guess, to do something like that. And it's not really something that I think would be effective. But if there were ways to methods, prompts, ways to informally get together and talk about our experiences or hear each other's stories, I think it would be a different kind of situation. I mean, I'm thinking about, it's so funny that you're doing a podcast, because of course I'm thinking about Only Murders in the Building. When you
I
think about
love that show.
the people who
My
lived in that building more or less didn't know each other, right? Until the murder. And then now everybody knows each other. So there is some mechanism. I'm not suggesting the humanities is all about murder, but there is some mechanism that brought everybody together to realize, oh, wait, we share this space and we're stakeholders in this space. So what is another mechanism that you can use? Now, one of them could be fighting gentrification or fighting in development or something like that. That's one way that you get together. Another way might just be a story circle. So one of the projects that I worked on a few years ago was also around a development project on the East Village. But what we did was we collected oral histories from people who had lived in the neighborhood for a very long time to kind of understand their sense of place. Like, how does this become your neighborhood? How does this constitute something for you? Sometimes just hearing your neighbor's stories, understanding what they've been through, how they connect to your neighborhood, and finding common ground that way builds a sense of common purpose. So you realize that your neighbor across the hallway was probably different from you. Maybe you feel like it would be awkward to talk to them, but you go to them and say, I have a class project and I'm interviewing my neighbors, and I just wanted to ask you some questions about your life story. And do you have time? We can schedule it, whatever. Kind of like you reached out to me. Maybe they are open to it, and you sit down for half an hour and an hour and you have a conversation with them. And then suddenly that person trusts you more and is like, hey, when you see each other in the hallway, and like, hey, you want to get tea or something like that. And you understand what drives that person and how they are trying to build a life and a sense of belonging where they are. And I think that is like the bare bones of community organizing, is to build trust and common cause with your neighbors. And that's something that the humanities can really do, is it's all about, I mean, it's not all about, but it's very much about using the methods of the humanities to open your heart and listen and care about other people and learn how to express yourselves.
But thank you so much again for having me interview you. This was a great experience. Just listening to
Sure.
your input. And yeah, thank you so much again. I really appreciate this.